Plant on the Line. This is the commentary.ca. Daniel Francis joins me now to talk about his recent book, Red Light Neon, published by Subway Books and retailing for $22. The book is a history of the sex trade industry in Vancouver. How much hypocrisy is there surrounding prostitution in Vancouver? What have the police and politicians done? How is it impacting life in the city? We'll attempt to answer these questions and more, including discuss the Picton trial and how it makes for a sad chapter in the history of the sex trade in Vancouver and the city itself. It's a fascinating book on a less than comfortable subject. Daniel Francis is a popular historian who edited the remarkable Encyclopedia of British Columbia and who has written some 22 other books, including LD, Mayor Lewis Taylor, and The Rise of Vancouver. He is a regular contributor to Geist. I am pleased to welcome Daniel Francis to the Plant on the Line program. Good morning, Mr. Francis.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. This book has been out for a while now. Last winter, was it?
Yeah, I think officially in February, but it sneaked into the bookstores a little before Christmas, too.
And I only got to read it this past summer, and I found it fascinating. Not because it was about the sex trade itself, but because it seemed to me that the history of Vancouver could be gleaned from the history of the sex trade. How much of Vancouver's history is there in this book?
Well, I'm glad that's the way you read it, because that's certainly the way I'd hoped it would be received. I got into it, actually, because of the book about Louis Taylor that you mentioned earlier, Vancouver's longest-serving mayor. And he was always getting involved in political scandals, and most of them had to do with his attitudes towards vice and towards prostitution. So it dawned on me that prostitution itself might make a separate subject, but certainly through his career we can see the close connection the prostitution's always had with the political life of the city, and also with its geography, the way prostitutes have been moved from one neighborhood to another, and how various neighborhoods have been associated with the vice trade. So it's closely tied to the history of the city.
In terms of the in the book, you discuss low track versus high track. And for people who haven't read the book yet, what does that mean? What is the distinction made there?
Well, I guess low track is considered to be the downtown east side and slightly east of there, where the dominant form of prostitution is street prostitution, and most people are involved in it for what's known as survival sex. They basically make their living in order to buy drugs to feed their addiction. High track is, at the moment, is located centrally more on the western side of downtown, and it's more expensive with a different kind of clientele.
And in terms of numbers, I think I read somewhere that there are about 2,000 sex trade workers in the city today. Is that correct?
I think it's really hard to say. I say in the book that there's 200 to 300 working on the streets in any particular night. But certainly, given that by most studies, the street trade is only about 20% of the total trade, then your number is probably correct.
And in terms of the 200 to 300 that are on the street every night, is there a difference between, are they in the low track or the high track, or how does it break down?
I wouldn't know specifically for high, middle, and low, but I would guess it's perhaps equal numbers in each of the three areas. There's a so-called middle track, and this is what police tell me. There's a so-called middle track out along the Kingsway.
Now, you said 20% of the figure are on the streets at night. The other 80% are what?
Escort agencies, massage parlors, call girl operations, all the variants of sex work that takes place indoors.
Now, escort agencies and massage parlors, are they licensed by the city?
Yes.
Now, what the I guess this is something that politicians deal with every so often, how to deal with the sex trade. There's regulation in that sense, and then on the street there isn't, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And many of these indoor things are legitimate activities. I'm not saying every massage parlor is a brothel. But certainly that's one form of, you use the word hypocrisy as I do, to describe the situation, and that's one of the reasons why we're caught in this hypocritical situation, is that the city is often described as a pimp. The city makes money off this business, but at the same time it attempts to suppress and illegalize.
And currently, we'll go into the history in a sec, but currently, is there a move amongst politicians to do anything about the sex trade in terms of making it legal, perhaps? Or, I mean, there's always calls for that, but there seems to be no movement.
No, I would agree there's no movement. There's two ways of looking at it, I suppose. At the federal level, there was a parliamentary committee holding hearings across the country over the past year. I believe their report came out in the spring. And they heard testimony from people all across the country and then decided not to do anything about changing the federal laws. And at the same time, there was mention of legalized red light zones or something like that, legalized brothels, in the last Vancouver civic election, and it was quickly attacked as an outrageous idea and didn't get anywhere. And yet at the same time, there is quite an interesting process that's been going on in the city. It's called something like Living in Communities, which is a community consultation process involving police, representatives of the sex trade, and so on, who held open public hearings to get people's points of view. They've produced a couple of reports, and they're attempting to deal with the negative issues that arise from street prostitution, and they're coming forward with proposals and so on. So on the one hand, there is nothing happening, and on the other hand, I think there's quite positive things happening.
And in terms of a solution to the problem, I guess the problem is that these sex trade workers are not safe, that they're you know, the threat of violence and so on and is prevalent. Is legalization, do you think, the answer?
Yeah, well, you know, what's a problem, of course, as you suggest, is your point of view. People who would abolish it entirely think the problem is that prostitution exists. People who think it should be legalized or regulated in some way think the problem is the law and our attitudes towards it. So it very much depends on one's point of view. You asked me what my opinion would be, and I think we should find some way of allowing this activity to go on in a way that allows the participants to work in safety.
And I guess this goes into the idea of the points of view. Is the prostitute then, the prostitute has been viewed over the years as a criminal. We've seemed to move away from that, haven't we?
That's right, yeah. Technically, prostitution's not illegal, just all the activities surrounding it are, so that the law at the moment, what is illegalized is communicating for the purposes of prostitution, not prostitution itself. And before that, it was soliciting to commit prostitution. So the prostitution itself is not illegal, it's these activities that surround it.
One of the things that you talked about earlier that I found fascinating in the book is this idea of geography. And the areas of the city where this sort of work goes on, have they always been where they were? Like, I mean, you go to the downtown east side, or you go into certain strolls in the West End or in downtown?
Yeah, now it depends on how far back you want to go. Let's say in the early part of the 20th century, the 1900s, the main area of brothels was on what now is Pender Street, down at the entrance to Chinatown. Then it was called DuPont Street, but it changed its name to Pender later on. And that strip down near where the Chinese Arch is now was just lined with brothels, let's say 1904. But then the city started to expand out of its origins in Gastown and was moving in that direction. And, of course, prostitution generally is always kept on the fringes, so in the margins of society, physically, morally kind of, and geographically as well. So it became a bit of an embarrassment, and the city government had to find places to put it. So they push it out of one area, and they pushed it into the area that's now Shanghai Alley, Canton Alley. That area was a strip for a while, and then in 1912, the brothels relocated onto Alexander Street down towards the waterfront below Powell, north of Powell. So from the very beginning, the prostitution was sort of pushed around and moved into various areas that quickly became associated with it, and then for whatever reason pushed out of those areas as well.
Now the pushing around, is that because politicians obviously do that, but I mean, is that because of the people that live in those neighborhoods say they want them out?
That's certainly what happened later on. In the period of the 80s, which I cover in the book, where the so-called West End period, which was when Davie Street, west of Burrard, became the center for street prostitution in the late 70s and early 80s, competition, if you will, with the neighborhood reached its peak. I think it got really ugly. Vigilante committees were forming in neighborhoods, and it became very clear that the neighborhood wanted the women out, and eventually that occurred. Then they moved to Mount Pleasant, and the same thing occurs over and over. I think it's in that period where really prostitutes are pitted against neighborhoods more than in the earlier period.
And did you find that there's hypocrisy on the part of the people in the neighborhoods?
Well, I can quite understand that there's accompanying behavior that makes life quite intolerable if you live in a neighborhood that's been taken over by street prostitution, as happened in the West End at the time. So I'm not sure I blame neighbors, but clearly this idea of just not in my backyard is not a sufficient response.
And is there a consensus, do you think, to the response today? You talked about these reports that have come out from Parliament and so on. Do you find that there will be more done on this in the future?
I'm actually quite fairly pessimistic, although that living in communities process I mentioned certainly seems very positive, so maybe I'm wrong to be pessimistic. But generally speaking, what I find is the debate is still very polarized in the way that it was 100 years ago. And because of the polarization, politicians are able to say, well, you know, we can't get unanimity on this issue, so we're not going to do anything. And the two poles are, of course, on the one side, people who want to legalize or decriminalize prostitution, find some way of letting it take place in a safe environment, as opposed to those who feel quite genuinely, of course, that it's a form of oppression of women, and there's no way that the state should be condoning it.
In terms of who the sex trade worker is, we hear of human trafficking and that sort of thing in the papers. It makes for good fodder on television and so on. Is the sex trade worker in Vancouver today, would they be someone who grew up in Vancouver, or would they be someone that was brought in from elsewhere?
Both, you know. I think the little I understand that part of the business, I think there's a fair amount of trafficking, not as we understand human trafficking internationally, but there are these circuits set up along the west coast from Alberta out to BC, down into California, Nevada, where women are kind of run by pimps, and police have told me that, you know, Las Vegas is the center for this, and that women are moved through this area. Lots of the women would be people who come from the interior or for other provinces and end up working in prostitution here. Lots, of course, are women who have fallen into addiction and use prostitution to support their habits, so they'd be local. Again, I'm not an expert on the issue of international trafficking, although I touch a bit on it in the book, and I just don't know how much it's taking place in Vancouver at this time. You read about it, and there's sensational stories in the press every once in a while about a brothel discovered in Richmond or something full of women who've come from another country. But it seems to me you also notice that it drops out of the news pretty quickly, and no criminal proceedings ever take place. So you wonder what's actually happening there.
Something you touch about in the book that I found Zionism movement of the 60s and 70s, did that have any effect on the sex trade?
Yeah, I think it did. I think there's a real connection. In 1970, I guess it was, there was a royal commission into the, I forget the precise title, but into the position or condition of women in Canada, something like that. And in response to that, there was changes, important changes to the federal law in 1972, shortly after that royal commission reported. The main law up until that point had been so-called VAG-C, vagrancy law, a section of the criminal code. And it was repealed, and so that prostitutes were basically treated as vagrants under this law. And it was repealed and replaced with the solicitation law, which was in place from 72 to, 85, I think, 86. So that was one example of how feminism related to prostitution. I think the other at the moment is that, and feminism is not monolithic, but there certainly is a branch of feminist thought that is intolerant of prostitution, feels it's a form of oppression, and works to have it abolished. And is not so. And yet there's another who sees the issue as from quite the opposite point of view, that prostitutes should be able to work in safety, and if they want to be prostitutes, they should be free to carry on that business.
Have you been following the Picton trial at all, Daniel?
I read it in the press like anybody else.
And this plays a part in your book that you write about it. This focused the attention on the downtown east side a great deal. A lot of the women the missing women were in the sex trade, correct?
Yeah, just to clarify, I write about the missing women a bit in the book, not about the Picton trial, which, of course, I can't write about and started.
Correct.
Yeah, into the book anyway.
But this story has sort of focused the attention on the sex trade and the workers in the downtown east side. Do you find that in the downtown east side in recent years, since this has come to the fore, that it's safer for a worker there?
Gee, you know, I don't think I'd be qualified to speak to that. All I know is what I hear and read in the press from people who work in the business down there, and I don't think anybody's feeling any safer. I think the issue goes far beyond Picton. There are, 60-some-odd women on the missing women's list, and I don't think anybody has suggested that one person is responsible for it. The problem is that the law, I think, puts certain prostitutes, street prostitutes, in marginal positions where they can be terrorized by certain predators. And it's not just one, you know, wouldn't have been just one predator. At one point, as I mentioned in the book, the police sort of rounded up the names of everybody, all the males they had on record, who could have been suspects in the missing women case, and it came to something like 600.
I guess the question would be if this sort of has become sort of the tipping point, and has there in a tipping point in the sex trade that perhaps more could be done, and that's why we've seen more reports. And the police are a little more sensitive to the missing women when they weren't at the time.
I agree with that.
Do you find that we've focused more attention on this, that you're able to write a book about the sex trade because of the events in the last 10 years or so?
I'm not sure that's how I'm able to write a book about it, but I think you're right. I think the issue has gotten a little more attention, but then again, you wonder what the concrete beneficial results of it are in terms of legal change or whatever, and you don't see them yet. But yes, one hopes that the attention that's been focused on it will result in something positive happening, sure.
How has the reaction been to the book?
I would say muted. It got a fair amount of attention in the press, but I don't, I'm not sure. The sales have not been all that good, so I can't judge.
And what are you working on now, may I ask?
I'm just going to be publishing a book next month on quite a change of pace on the history of the killer whales on the coast and the involvement of the aquarium with them over the years.
That's from Harbor, correct?
Yes.
And we'll await that, but I do urge people to pick up your book, Red Light Neon, because it is a really interesting book about the city. If you're like me, in terms of reading about Vancouver, having lived here and so on, it's a fascinating book. And Daniel, congratulations on it, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for asking me, Joe.
Daniel Francis is the author of Red Light Neon, A History of Vancouver Sex Trade, published by Subway Books, $22. I'm Joseph Planta.